This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
Hello, junkies, and welcome to a horrifying new episode of Junk Food Cinema right here on FilmSchoolRejects.com. This is your weekly cult and exploitation film cast that is so good, it just has to be fattening, just like all the candy you're going to eat in just a few weeks.
Except Snickers bars, because don't give out Snickers bars this year, apparently.
That's bullshit. Always give out Snickers bars.
I give out full-size fucking candy bars that include full-size Snickers.
I'm sorry, are we in Soviet Russia? No. Give out full-size Snickers bars because this is America and it's Halloween, goddammit! I am your host, Diane Salisburied, and I am joined, as per usual, by my friend and co-host, novelist, screenwriter, Lieutenant of Megaforce, C. Robert Carkill.
I knew you were going for Carkill.
Yeah, that's it's just because I haven't thought of a new one since last year.
Yeah, there we go.
And if you want to hear more of us, you want to hear more of me being not so clever, check out our back catalog of episodes on iTunes as well as Stitcher. You can also follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema and like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. And hey, if you really like the podcast, which I hope you do, why not consider becoming a patron over on patreon.com/junkfoodcinema? For that, you pledge a little bit of change per episode, and for that, you get bonus episodes that only you guys get to hear, and you also help us keep the lights on and help us deliver content to you. We've taken to calling you Junkions, not just because it's kind of a mixture of junk food and Patreon, but also it's the name of a class of robot in Transformers the movie, which we covered not too long ago. So patreon.com/junkfoodcinema. And oh my goodness, it's the most wonderful time of the year.
Dude, just because Target is putting that stuff up already doesn't mean you have to start singing Christmas.
Oh, no, that's a Halloween song, because the most wonderful time of the year is in fact Halloween, and I am so freaking excited that October has arrived and we can start talking about horror movies 24/7.
Because that's not what we've been doing, like, for the last 2.5 years.
It was like,
you will, by the way,
12/3, I would say.
Junkies, I will point out that I am both cantankerous and my voice sucks this week.
Oh, you got the crud.
I got fantastic flu.
Yes, we just got finished with Fantastic Fest, which actually is the reason it inspired us to theme our horror movie month specifically around horror movies that we have seen at either South by Southwest or Fantastic Fest.
I'm even going to throw in a Fright Fest in there. Because let's go crazy. Dual continent. Let's go to the wonderful, wonderful wilds of London and visit one of their fantastic, amazing festivals.
Agreed.
Yeah, so, no, we've got some. We're gonna do some modern junk food for you this month. That's one of the things we love digging deep. We love going into the obscure stuff. We love dusting off stuff from like we did this summer with 1986. But this month, what we thought we might do is pull out some of those horror movies that you may or may not have heard of. You may have seen on the streaming services and been, is that any good? Or you may have heard about from your friends, or a handful of you may have been like, dude, I've already watched this. Well, good. Then you're already ready for this episode.
Yes.
So we're going to dig up some of our favorite lesser known festival gems and talk about some really good, solid modern horror that you may have missed.
That we will give our squeal of approval to. This is Call of Duty Modern Horrorfare or 2016's Festival of Fear. Kicking off the Festival of Fear is a movie that...
Is that what we're going to call it?
I guess, because Fear Fest was already taken, so... But these are all horror movies that we saw at festivals, so Festival of Fear... Again, not super clever. But this movie that we're going to talk about today is very clever. This is a film that played at, I believe it was South by Southwest, actually, was where this one debuted in 2014.
I know that it definitely played at Fantastic Fest.
It did play at Fantastic Fest?
Yes.
Okay. Well, then I may be wrong. It may actually... was it one of those situations where... I know for a while, Fantastic Fest... this says it played March 10th, 2014 at South by Southwest. I know that for a while, South by Southwest had like a Fantastic Fest at Midnight kind of collaboration.
Yeah, do they not have that anymore?
I don't believe they do, but I think this might have been one of those.
Okay, because I do know that it played Fantastic Fest, but then again, this is a film made by a friend of ours, produced by a friend of ours named Ant Timpson.
Yes.
Who, if any of you who are deep into the cinephile scene, he is this wonderful, delightfully crazy man from New Zealand who ran a New Zealand's first genre film festival and then would show up here in Austin every year with a bunch of culty trailers. And there was a whole host of the Austin scene, the bloggers that a lot of you may have grown up with, who started talking about all these weird, wild movies they were discovering. And they were discovering these movies because we'd watch the trailers that Ant Timpson would show us. And then people would be like, what the hell is this? Like, that's the first time I saw Sorceress, is when Timpson brought up a trailer of Sorceress. I'm like, that's the Battle Beyond the Stars theme. What the hell? How do I not know about Sorceress? And so I would track down Sorceress. And so he would do that for a while. And then he got involved in a bunch of various film festivals. And then he started producing New Zealand films. And now it is an odd day that a film comes out of New Zealand without Timpson's stamp of approval. Like I saw one earlier this year that was a New Zealand film and it didn't have Timpson's name on it. I'm like, what the happy horseshit is going on here?
He's kind of King Kiwi shit now.
He is. And he's great. The thing is he loves genre cinema. He loves tasteless humor. He loves serious, you know, fair. He gets involved with really good stuff and they try to make the best stuff they can with the great scene they have down there and very little money. And this is just such a little gem.
And yes, this was a movie called Housebound.
Your client has been through a number of these treatment programs in the past and the results have been less than spectacular. Miss Bucknell is in need of stability. I'm therefore ordering an urgent report into the suitability of a mother's house for a sentence of 8 months home detention.
Nice being back home.
Some things have happened since I've been here. Things I can't explain. I'm not the only one who thought there was a ghost in this house, Kylie.
What are you going to do against a hostile spirit?
I'm going to smash it in the face.
So, are you happy to proceed with the story that Mr. McRandall was attacked by a vengeful ghost?
Yes.
Righto.
The basic setup is that you have a girl named Kylie who has had a few run-ins with the law. She's what you might call a troubled young woman. At the beginning of the movie...
Or a repeat offender.
A repeat offender. A recidivist, if you will. And at the beginning of the movie, we see her and her, presumably her boyfriend, maybe just her partner in crime, trying to rip off an ATM and having a very Three Stooges time of it. Everything is going wrong in hilarious fashion and ends up with her ramming their getaway car over a parking, like a concrete divider, and getting caught. And the judge decides that the best thing for her is to be remanded to house arrest at her family's home. And there is the setup, except which would be fine. Seems like maybe a dramedy, perhaps, until you realize...
Well, I mean, this is also the setup for Disturbia.
Oh, I didn't know that, actually.
Have you not seen...
I guess I haven't seen Disturbia.
The Shia LaBeouf classic, Disturbia?
Is it based... I thought that was based on that Rihanna song. Is that not... It's not based on that Rihanna song?
No.
Okay,
no,
well, then not. I don't know anything about it. But yes, so it'd be all well and good, except for the fact that there appears to be a supernatural entity living in the old family home. It appears
that she's
to be
not allowed to leave.
That she's not allowed to leave. You're trapped with a ghost, which is a popular R. Kelly song, I believe, correct? Trapped with a ghost
also,
in the closet? No? Okay.
No.
Fair enough. So that's the setup of the movie. And what is so outstanding about this film, as far as I'm concerned, is that it is several different movies sort of rolled into one, because it has, throughout the course of this, and I must say that the horror elements of this movie are tremendously effective. It's got its spooky moments, it's got its great scares, but it is also very funny, and it's got this weird sort of oddball character comedy that feels like almost like an Edgar Wright movie. Like, the characters, like, a lot of the comedy comes from people just...
you know,
having their own strange reactions to larger than life events that take place, and the way that they react feels very, and the way that like music will cut out for a reaction also felt very Edgar Wright to me.
You know what? I hadn't put it in those terms, but you're absolutely right. Like, there's one really great moment of comedy where we have this character who is essentially, he's a security guy, and his job is, he lives in the neighborhood with Kylie. So his job, he has to rush over if she ever breaches, if she ever steps outside of her zone and she has a breach, something goes wrong with her bracelet. He runs over after she's had a spooky encounter, and the result is, you know, they just kind of unload and she doesn't want to tell the story, but the mom is. And then it's like, okay, we've just told this security officer that we believe the house is haunted. And there's this strange look on his face. He pulls out the tape recorder, and then he starts talking in, doing the setup for a narration for Tracking the Paranormal.
Yeah, he drops right into paranormal investigator mode, like without missing a beat. And it's so perfect. And actually, he's one of my favorite characters in the whole movie, because he does kind of start off as somebody who's just hired to keep watch over her. As a character named Amos, played by Glenn Paul Wanu. Who is hired basically just to keep an eye on her, make sure she doesn't, you know, exceed the household leave. And he just immediately falls into, as soon as they tell him the house is haunted, he looks like a kid on Christmas, just lights up like, okay, well, we're going to, he even has a line where the mom says, I can't pay you. And he goes, furthering the field of paranormal research is payment enough, is reward enough. And it's so over the top, and yet it makes you instantly like this character.
Oh yeah. He's hilarious.
Very funny guy.
Yeah, no, the entire movie has this really great wry humor about it. And this, like, you like the mother, like you feel in tune with the mother, but every time she opens her mouth, something else racist pops out.
Yeah.
And it's, and they walk this really fine line of you being there with the mother and just feeling like, and this is one of the things I think of the brilliance of the performance and the writing, is it puts you right in with Kylie. Like, you like this woman. You don't hate this woman. But the things that are coming out of her mouth are embarrassing to you as a person that you're even listening to this and that you like this person. It's profoundly well done, just in how realistic that portrayal is, where she seems like she feels vindicated and she feels entitled to these terrible opinions. And then at the same time, she is a loving mother and she does put up with a lot and she is very much trying to get by in a very odd situation. Now, here's the thing we need to talk about. So if you have not seen this movie yet, if you're listening to this,
probably best to put this on pause right now.
Yeah, this is the part where if we have not sold you on a funny paranormal film at this point, then, you know, we're about to spoil it for you, because the spoilers for this are pretty monumental, because this movie is actually two different movies.
Yes.
And the big kicker, of course, for those of you that have watched it, and those of you who are like, fuck it, I'll watch it later, is that there is no ghost in the house.
Yeah.
It is not a paranormal film. Instead, there is a mentally deranged man named Eugene, who is entirely harmless, living in the walls of this house.
So, yeah, I've been doing a lot of writing, like screenwriting and creative writing recently. And the rule that I've come to live by is that one good turn deserves another when you're talking about a story, because if you have a story that's going one way and you take a left turn on the audience, that's something. But if that turn isn't the last turn, if something else indeed is going on, if you can structure your story in such a way that there are multiple big discoveries that happen naturally throughout the course of characters investigating something, that's when you've really got something. And that's something that this movie definitely pushes hard, is that idea. Because at first, yes, you think it's a straight-up haunted house movie. You think it is a supernatural entity. They talk a lot about that. They talk about, you know, EKG, and they talk about, you know, trying to use audio recordings to catch the ghost on tape. And there is actually a moment where there's a moment with a teddy bear that freaked me the fuck out, that
The Teddy Ruxpin clone?
The Teddy Ruxpin clone that is just horrifying and makes you wonder if something supernatural is in fact going on. In fact, you don't doubt it throughout the course of the movie. There's no reason to. But then that first turn where it's like, oh no, there's somebody living in the walls.
Well, the first turn is, oh, hey, by the way, this house we've been living in actually used to be a halfway house,
yeah,
and a girl was murdered up in this room.
Which is in support of the first idea, the first red herring,
yes,
that there's something supernatural going on.
And then we find out Eugene is living in the walls.
And then it becomes, oh, Eugene, because our first introduction to Eugene, who is this crazy-haired, you know, he's got heterochromia, so his eyes are two different colors, his long nails. I mean, he looks like basically the Unabomber meets, it looks insane. And so we're introduced to him, and he's like, our hero Kylie is crawling through the walls, finds him, and then proceeds to kind of chase her through the walls and out into the, so it's like, okay, now we know what's going on. It's not a ghost. It's a crazy person living in the walls.
Well, in fact, for a moment, we also have a whole other subplot that we just kind of skipped over
because the
there's a lot of,
yeah,
them, with the crazy neighbor,
yeah,
who turns out not to be a crazy neighbor at all, but just some junker living next door,
yeah,
who, you know, used to take care of Eugene, and then Eugene took off one day and he hasn't seen him since.
Yeah.
And of course, because Eugene went to the house next door and started living there.
And that's what's really remarkable, is that it's a whodunit that we don't know was a whodunit until they've already eliminated two suspects.
Yeah.
How does that? That should not fucking work. You, yeah, should not be able to eliminate two suspects before the audience even knows they should be looking for suspects.
Yeah, no, it's what's so weird and wonderful about this movie, and what I really connect with it. The first experience watching this movie is tremendous, mm-hmm, because it is hilarious. It's constantly twisting and turning. You never know what kind of movie you're really watching.
Truth.
Until the final moment. In fact, we'll get there, but the final moment of this movie radically changes the rest of this movie. Like, this is a film that is constantly changing. And then the second time you watch it, you're watching a comedy about people blaming things on the supernatural and not, mm-hmm, lurking for other explanations. And there's several lines of dialogue that then set up that that's really what this movie is about. That ultimately, Housebound is a movie about how we are, our mind is prone to looking for supernatural explanations rather than actual explanations. And like, there's that whole thing with the DJ, when the DJ's kind of laying that out on the radio before mom calls in to explain her situation. And when you're watching that the second time around, it's a very different conversation, where the mom really sounds much crazier than the first time around, mm-hmm, because she's never noticed there's a guy. She's never put all these things together that somebody is living in our house.
Yeah.
And it's something that happens. Like, people will have people that just, a homeless person that takes up in their attic and moves around quietly and waits, comes down when everybody goes to work, and they steal some food and they go back up and nobody notices. And just sometimes food is gone. And I don't know why the ghost just likes moving shit around and creaking in the night and stealing food. Or you have somebody living in your attic.
Yeah.
And that's the case here. And they never get it. And so the film works on this completely different level, the second viewing, where you're putting together how these people and how these people come to believe these things, and how Kylie comes to believe it, and how Kylie has forgotten that she had encounters with this man when she was a very young child.
Yeah. And that's, I was just thinking too about this idea of a horror movie that's a whodunit that doesn't let the audience in on the fact that it's a whodunit until way late. And you know what immediately leapt to mind is Friday the 13th Part 5, A New Beginning, where you think it's something supernatural. You think it's just Jason Voorhees. You don't know it's a whodunit. And that actually works against that movie. Whereas I feel like it works very much against that movie. Whereas this feels like what I think that movie was trying to do, which is of turning on the audience and making them realize, like, oh no, there's somebody who is responsible. Oh no, but not that person. It's actually this one. So I guess what I'm saying is that Housebound is like, if they had done Friday the 13th Part 5, A New Beginning, right, which is a weird sentence that I never thought I would speak in my life, but there it is. And I do really like the way that they parcel out the information. And that DJ that you mentioned, that like call-in psychic guy, is a really great little function, because so much of the first act of this movie is Kylie in that house being either bored to tears, frustrated out of her mind with her parents, because this is a girl who ran away from home because she was constantly getting in trouble, didn't get along with her parents. So they've really kind of condemned her to her own personal hell by making her live there again for 8 months. And it's a great scene.
She's a total ass at that.
That is what's really remarkable about this movie, is that there is so much undertaken by this writer, who is also the director, Gerard Johnstone, if I'm mispronouncing that. Gerard Johnstone. Because he writes a character who, for the beginning of this movie, is not likable at all.
You have no reason to feel for her at all. She's just a pain in the ass. She has committed a crime. She's been sentenced to a light sentence of living at home with her mom, watching television, and she is just an asshole.
Yeah, like, the whole time. For no reason.
Like, just like, yeah, I was sitting on the couch and I ate the meatloaf you made for dinner tonight.
Yeah, and then and the mom's no apology. Like, the best line of that solidifies what horrible person Kylie is at the beginning of this movie is the mom says, well, I guess I gotta go to the store and get something else for dinner, and Kylie says, well, it's not like I can go.
Yeah.
And it's just like, man, wow, you're a bitch. Like, just like, you get to a point where you're just like, is this movie gonna change to the point where I like this girl? Because, man, not sold on her so far. Not a fan of Kylie, not team Kylie at all right now. And one of the first things they do that I think really starts, and I love the way this is parceled out, is that she wants to use the phone. Her mom says, I'm on the phone, it's an important call. So she goes in the other room, turns on the radio, and that's when she figures out her mom is calling in to the psychic. And it's a really great way to do two things. One, really further push the idea that her and her mom are very different people and why they don't get along, and also that the house is haunted. Like, it's such a great delivery system for that little piece of exposition.
Yeah.
And one that it's not like the standard, like, something weird happens and then she's like, oh, is the house haunted? No, this is straight up being told. It's almost like a Hitchcock move where it's like, I'm going to tell you there's a bomb in that briefcase over there and you're going to spend the rest of the movie waiting to see if it goes off. Like, it's a very cool move that I liked a lot. And once they start getting into that supernatural, what you think is supernatural, they deliver those scares so well that there's no reason for the audience to at all suspect that there's anything but a ghost.
Yeah.
In that house, and it's beautiful, and I love that about it. And then once we start investigating, it's so the way these pieces are put into place so naturally is how this movie is able to twist on you not once, not twice, I mean really three or four times, because they naturally introduce that her, you know, the guy in charge of making sure she doesn't run out is a paranormal investigator, becomes an investigation. As such, we start learning about the murder in the house. When it was a halfway house. As such, we start learning about the creepy neighbor. You know, what does he know? And it's just, I love that. It reminds me of like Innkeepers, like Ty West Innkeepers, where it's like, it's got that element of comedy, but it's also got really effective scares, and it works really well.
Yeah. And we haven't even gotten into the fact that it then turns into a thriller.
What the fuck? Because at this point, it's like, okay, oh, I get it. There's a crazy guy in the walls. This is a Klaus Kinski in Crawl Space situation. Obviously, he's deranged. I mean, just look at him, and he's coming after her. And then we start to realize there's a great scene that I love, where it's that same fucking Teddy Ruxpin clone comes back again. He becomes another plot point, where they find a tape inside and they realize that it's the kind of toy where you could record your own messages.
Yeah.
It's kind of a Talkboy bear. So the paranormal investigator, Amos, puts it into his tape recorder and realizes that what the bear's been saying has been recorded messages that Kylie recorded when she was little, and saying things like, my friend who lives in the walls, and I wouldn't tell mom about you, and, you know, my name's Kylie. And then he has just at this point learned that the next door neighbor basically ended up with an illegitimate child that he, like, kept in a crawl space because he was very technically savvy, and then...
Because he only wanted to live in the crawl space.
He just wanted to live in the crawl space. He wasn't a fan of open spaces. He was agoraphobic to the point that he wanted to live in a crawl space.
But he was
at the neighbor's house.
Broken. Like, that's the interesting thing. Yeah. He took an animal and took parts off the animal and tried to put the parts back together on backwards. And at that point, the neighbor flipped out and took a tire chain to him, and Eugene took off and was never seen again.
And they assumed he just left town, but turns out he just went to the house next door. And this was about a year before the girl at the halfway house that was going on in the house before was murdered. So everything in the movie is starting to point toward Eugene is in the house. He's the one that killed the girl when it was a halfway house, and he's still there. So they put the tape in, and they realize that, yes, she's been talking to Eugene as a child, which is set up really beautifully in a line when her and her mother are arguing, and she says, you know, you used to think this house was haunted too. Like, I'm not the only one who thinks the house was haunted. When you were little, you thought this house was haunted too. And it turns out she thought the house was haunted because she was talking to her friend in the walls, Eugene. So now we're set down that path. Now it's got to be Eugene that's the killer, right? No.
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 What the fuck?
Eugene's totally harmless.
Then there's this, like, this is what's really fantastic is that all these little, tiny, almost insignificant things that lead to huge revelations. And aside from a talking teddy bear, the other one is a set of dentures. A set of dentures that weighed in heavily in the crime scene where the girl was killed at the halfway house. And Kylie notices that her social worker has that same set of dentures late in the movie. And she starts to suspect he was involved, goes down to the basement, finds the records of the halfway house. He was an employee here. There was an incident with him and that girl where she kicked the crap out of him. Oh my gosh, he's the killer. And it goes out of control from there and becomes this crazy, like, your next level violent, like, thriller where you can't seem to kill this social worker. Like, they stab him, he's fine. They throw him off a roof, he's fine. They end up having to dispatch him in a way that is so fucking amazing.
So New Zealand.
So New... Yes, absolutely like, New Zealand.
It is one of those crazy, fucked up, holy shit New Zealand.
The most Peter Jackson of Peter Jackson
and
moments.
See, that's the thing is that, you know, New Zealand genre films, man, do they love going over the top.
Like, yeah.
That is a hallmark of all of their genre. There's so much great genre coming out of New Zealand over the last decade, and one of the hallmarks is even in a film like this that is so tight and so restrained for much of the point, we get to a point where they stick a fork,
they call it a meat fork.
A meat fork.
Yeah.
Hooked up to cables into the guy's throat. And as he goes to pull it out, you hear, you know, you kind of track along the wire and you see Eugene has hooked some crazy thing up and he flips the switch and the guy's like, oh, and then like splatters, just entire head explodes.
I honestly think that the whole reason it was set up that Eugene was very technically inclined was for this kill. Was just to justify this kill, which is so perfect because you think the social worker's dead because he's been thrown off a roof. He comes back into the house and is choking mom, and Kylie's been punched and she's like just like regaining consciousness, and you see this little hand pop out of the cupboard and like tap her on the head to wake her up and then hand her the meat fork, which, by the way, a meat fork is how the little girl in the halfway house was murdered.
Yeah.
So that's how Eugene has a habit of collecting little things from the house. So he has it and he hands it to her and she stabs him. And then, yeah, you track along that wire and he flips it on and kersploosh, a head explosion that is just, I mean, pardon the expression, to die for. It is phenomenal. I love that kill, but it does make me think that the reason that he was set up to be technically inclined is just so we get that awesome kill.
But to be fair, it is his defining character trait and what makes him interesting and what makes the house interesting, because the house has had all these eccentricities for years. Mm-hmm. And as you put it together, and that's one of the interesting things about watching it a second time, is seeing all the things that Eugene has been doing over the years.
Yeah.
That's just been a pain in the ass to live with, you know, just the rewiring of stuff and stuff going out and then stuff working again, like out of the blue, like this computer fried and now my computer's working again. Like what the
fuck? Oh, that's true. Yeah. No, that's true. And the fluctuations in their power bill that they keep talking about.
Yeah. And so all of that, yeah, all of this stuff that's set up leads these people to believe that there's some force in the house just fucking with things. And really, there's just a little pack rat running around fixing or fucking with everything.
Yeah.
And then, of course, that leads to our final moment of the film. You know, Eugene had been stabbed, guy's head explodes, everybody's been beat up. So we find ourselves with Kylie finally getting, 7 months later, she's getting her
bracelet taken off, her anklet taken off.
Yeah, her anklet's taken off. They're cutting it off. They have a nice little ceremony. They're filming it, you know, because, hey, you know, your time is up. You can go back to
because
your
mom,
life.
One of the things I like about this mom character is, like, her ability to see the big picture is a little skewed. And at the very beginning of this movie, she has this great quote where they're talking about how the anklet works. And they're talking about if you do this, if you do that. And she says,
"Gosh, that's high tech, isn't it? Aren't you lucky, Kylie, having all that fancy technology on your foot?"
It's like, wait, no, Mom. Like, this is how they keep me under arrest. Like, or like later Kylie has just a... like a basic flip phone, and she's like, "Is that one of those new iPhones?" Like, her ability to see the big picture is so skewed that she's like, "Oh, we need to record this moment for posterity." I'm like, "No, because again, it's the anklet that signified your daughter was under house arrest." I'm not sure it's the graduation moment you think it is, but she's just kind of a little lost
from
reality.
"Oh, yeah, what kind of special tool do you have for this?" And he pulls out scissors.
Yeah.
She's like, "Really, that's it?" And he's like, "Yeah, we'll just throw it in the bin, or you can keep it." And then the camera dies.
Yeah.
And then it's like, "Ma," and she starts instantly yelling at her mother.
Yeah.
"Why didn't you charge it?" "I did. It was sitting on the charger all night." And then she just stops, and final line of the movie is, "Eugene!" And you realize
he's still living in the walls. They're
a big happy family now. Yeah. And now it's like her brother has been fiddling with the electricity again and been fucking around, and her camera is dead. And like, this is what this has become. Like, this creepy guy who was living in the walls is still there and is now part of this big happy family. And it becomes this adorable, heartwarming ending that just makes you fall in love with the crazy thrillerness of it, because it becomes a 90s thriller.
Like, oh, it for 10 absolutely
minutes,
does.
It is a 90s thriller. We are chasing... There is no room in the house that they don't run around in. There is nothing they don't try to use as a weapon. In fact, one of my favorite things in this movie is that she goes to the kitchen and she grabs two things. She grabs a butcher knife and a cheese grater. She puts a cheese grater on her arm that she then uses.
Like a gauntlet. Like a motherfucking cheese grating gauntlet.
That she then uses on the villain's face. And it's kind of fucking amazing. And so, but for 10 minutes, it is just a thriller. And it is like, okay, I hope this does something else with this. Because we've kind of seen that a billion times.
Yeah.
And there isn't a lot of originality until the fork kill in that chase that then gets totally flipped with that decision to do that with Eugene.
Yeah, and that's what's great is, in any other movie, if that had been the entirety of the movie, if the whole movie had been us trying to figure out who the killer is, then I feel like it would have felt very conventional and it would have felt very boring. But one, that's just a small sliver of the third act. And two, we don't even know that's where we're going until we get there. And then they punctuate it so well with that head explosion kill. And also, one of the things that I really feel that third act explores in a very cool way is, it's a claustrophobic horror film in that it all takes place within this house. All of the scares really take place within this house, and that's really challenging when you're trying to set an entire horror movie inside one location. You know, when you're trying to really spread out and do something big with the scares, eventually you just run out of rooms. And one of the things I think they did really well in the character of Eugene is there's like a whole secondary location within the location. The innards of this house that you can't see become an entirely separate setting. So they're able to chase not only through the house, but then into the sort of labyrinth of the innards of the house that Eugene lives in. And I thought that was really cool, because they get trapped in one room running from the social worker who's trying to kill them, and they literally find Eugene's tunnel through the bathroom cupboard into the walls again. And then you get that great moment where it's like they can hear the doorbell, they know Amos is there, they're trying to warn him, they can't. So it reminded me of like when we were watching Lights Out, and the girl's crawling through, you know, all of the vent shafts and between the walls. It's like, that's really great because it opens up a small confined location to be kind of twice the size if you can really get in between the walls like that and still do a lot of effective things. And that's what's great is at every turn of this movie, when it becomes something else, it does every one of those movies very well.
Yes.
So every time it switches to something else, every time the tone switches, every time the subgenre switches, essentially, it does that thing that it's doing at that moment very well. So it's disciplined enough to function as a comedy, to function as a supernatural horror film, to function as a horror film that's more, you know, terrestrial, and then function as a 90s thriller.
And then on the second viewing, it functions entirely as a breakdown of why people end up equating things to supernatural phenomenon.
Yeah.
Like it is a wonderful breakdown of that in terms of how it does that in on its second viewing. Like, it is so many things done right in so many ways.
And it's, you know, there's just things that can't be explained because you don't, I mean, I think it kind of takes the audience on that ride, and that idea of this is why people think their houses are haunted, because there are crucial bits of information that you would never think to equate to the situation that once you have it, everything starts to make sense. But I mean, you don't ever think somebody living in the walls, which is just as terrifying to me as there being a ghost in the house. But things start disappearing, moving on their own, lights on and off on their own. It's not happening on its own, but you would never leap to the conclusion that somebody's living in the walls of your house. So your only other option, it's like a weird Occam's razor phenomenon. Like, the only other option you can leap to is there's a ghost in the house. So yeah, it is. It's like if you were watching The Changeling and halfway through, it's like, oh, there's a weird little kid living in the walls. Okay, I guess that's less supernatural, but still really interesting. And I wanted to say something about, there's a, when you're talking about the mom and her being a little bit racist, it's something you don't necessarily catch right away, because the way she's racist is she's racist against the Maori.
Yeah.
Which in America, it's like you can't, if you're not familiar with New Zealand and its culture, you're probably like, why is she surprised at meeting a well-educated Maori? And then, you know, it's the indigenous people of New Zealand. It's kind of like the Aborigines of Australia.
Yeah, like, like the Aborigines of Australia.
These are the New Zealand, the native New Zealanders. So it's just, but you're right. When you watch that scene, it is really off-putting that she's just like, she was very well-spoken. It's so nice to meet an educated one. And you realize you hear those same things from racist relatives in this country about a different ethnic group. Yeah. But you're right. Like, that moment is kind of...
Racism is international.
Racism is international. The group names may differ, but racism is international. That's one thing this movie definitely teaches us. And also with Eugene, one of the things that really impressed me with this movie is how quickly and how effectively they're able to make you see different sides of Eugene. Because when you first meet him, you are convinced that he is the killer. He's an insane person. He's the monster of the movie. And then there's this amazing scene where she starts looking at, he doesn't have a camera, so what he does is he draws pictures of things that he's able to see through his various, through, you know, vent covers or through holes he's made in the wall. And it's just this really sweet moment where it's like, here was you on the first day of school, and it's just like from the top of the stairs looking at the doorway, and here's you when you, you know, got expelled, and
here's you when you punched your mom.
You punched your mom, and then, you know,
here's what you when you ran away, and here's me and your mom waiting for you to come back.
So beautiful. My heart just broke for that guy in that moment. And
there's that great moment where she screams at him.
Yeah.
And then she turns around to talk to her mother and turns back, and he's put on his headphones and he's watching TV because he can't take it.
Yeah.
Like, he's tuned out. At that moment, you realize how harmless he is.
What an emotionally fragile and yet, yeah, totally harmless. Like, there's even a line where he says, like, I take little things, but I always put them back. He's not even really a thief.
No.
He's a borrower. He's literally a borrower. He lives in the walls and he takes things when he needs them and then he brings them back. It's a great thing where every single character in this movie has depth, and every, like, even though it's funny, like, you still feel for these characters, you still, you know, root for them. Like, when I thought Amos was going to die, I was hardcore bummed. Like, I love that character. I really wanted him to stick around. And I have to say, I liked this movie, but watching it for this show, I realized I hadn't seen it all the way through. There's no way, because I remember thinking this movie was about a crazy guy in the walls when everyone thought it was a ghost. But that was only turn, two, I think, of this race. And it turns out there's a lot more going on with Housebound. It's so well written, so well shot, and every time there's a turn, I mean, it just feels like a bigger movie with every turn.
Yeah.
It feels like a bigger, more accomplished movie with every twist.
And it's one of those sad cases where someone acquired the rights to this, I believe, to remake it,
uh-huh,
rather than distribute an already perfect film. Like, I don't, It's one of those things where it's like that. It's they're speaking with a New Zealand accent. Like you it's not a foreign language. You can put this in theaters. People will watch this and it's great.
Yeah. Apart from maybe not knowing who the Maori are, there's nothing in this movie that's going to distance it from American audiences.
No. And there's nothing that doesn't make it look like it's not in the Pacific Northwest.
True.
I mean, they've got a Pacific Coast Highway, that they live off of.
Yeah.
And they live in this small town where it's perpetually wet and green. So it's like nobody, people just recognize the accents and go, oh, they must be Australian. And then the New Zealanders would be like, no, fuck you. We're from New Zealand. By the way, the one mistake never to make, never assume someone is from Australia.
Ooh, never call a Kiwi an Aussie. No. Never call a Kiwi an Aussie.
They really take that personally.
When you put an overactive mind in an inactive environment, there's bound to be complications.
I don't need a counseling session. I just need to get out of this house.
And that brings us to the junk food pairing, which I can't promise every movie we do this month will be paired with alcohol, but something felt very appropriate about pairing this movie with a New Zealand beer called Epic Hop Zombie. Just a horror-themed beer from New Zealand for this New Zealand horror film. If you like hops, like zombies like brains, check out Epic Hop Zombie Beer and have yourself a good time with Housebound, which is, by the way, on Netflix. Very accessible. Might be the most accessible movie we're going to talk about during this stretch.
Maybe.
It might be, because it's just right there streaming for you. So, highest of recommendations for Housebound, the first
movie.
I have
a couple other recommendations that I know are definitely streaming.
Oh, good.
So, yeah, no, this will be a very accessible month of easy-to-find things that you should be able to digest. And, in fact, Brian and I are going to sit down and do the battle planning on exactly which ones we're going to watch, because I know that I have three options that I want to suggest, and I know he's got some. So we will figure out what
it's like
the next few weeks.
It's like a big game of Risk, which is ironic, because what I always do in Risk first is, like, New Zealand, Papua New Guinea, just fucking build it up. That's my entry point for every game of Risk. But yes, Housebound, the first movie of Festafear 2016. Thank you for joining us. Hope you'll be back next week when we talk about another movie, another horror film that we discovered at a film fest. If you like the show and you want to hear more of us, definitely check us out on iTunes and Stitcher. You can also follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema. Like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. And certainly contribute to that Patreon account. We are getting closer every day to our goal of $300 an episode, at which time you guys will be able to send me, or somebody pointed this out to me during Fantastic Fest, and I don't know why I didn't think of it. If you don't want to spend the money to mail me the movie, you could always just send me a link to where to find it.
Yeah. Have a bunch of streaming services.
I do have a bunch of streaming services, so that's also a possibility. But the bottom line is, if we hit that $300 per episode goal, patrons will be able to send me movies, force me to watch them, and I will have to do a review for them. And before we go, I do want to give a shout out. We had a couple of new $10 pledges. Thank you guys so much. Joe Holt, thank you so much. I assume you're not related to Steve Holt from Arrested Development, but maybe you are. Joe Holt pledged $10. You are an American hero, as is Krasimir Valjak, who pledged $10. I'm going to go out on a limb and say Krasimir is not an American hero, but a hero of the world nonetheless. As well, A.T. Smith, pledger of $10. Guys, we are getting so close to that goal. A.T. Smith, you are part of the A-team, A.T. Smith. Thank you so much for that. Cargo, where can people find you online?
You can find me on Twitter at twitter.com/massaworm. That's MASSAWYRM. Or on Facebook, facebook.com/massaworm. Also, coming up here in just a few weeks, you can go to a local cinema house and see our little movie, Doctor Strange.
Yes, go to your local art house theater and see Marvel's Doctor Strange.
Marvel's Doctor Strange, our small little indie weird film.
Written by Cargill, directed by Jim Jarmusch, I believe. Is that correct? You're the art house Doctor Strange? Is that what's happening?
That would be kind of neat. You know, I almost think we need to, the week Strange comes out, we need to review Dr. Mordred.
I'm demanding that we review Dr. Mordred.
The 1992 Charles Band Dr. Strange knockoff that he made without when he lost the rights.
I am demanding that we review Dr. Mordred the week that Dr. Strange comes out. There is something very synergetic about that I am not going to pass up. That is a great idea. So yes, definitely check out Dr. Strange as if you weren't going to already. Also, Cargill, thank you for adding a sort of late night DJ quality to the sound this week. You can find me on Twitter.
My voice is gone, dude. Fucking fantastic flu killed me.
The Fantastic Flu is a very real thing, guys. Every year,
it's on several continents right now. It went to Spain.
Yep.
I know it's in New Zealand. I know it's in the UK. I'm sure it's probably found its way to Asia as well.
It's like that final scene in Rise of the Planet of the Apes where you see the guy get on the airplane and then just like start going all over the world. Like that's how quickly it spreads. Every year, same deal. If you want to find me online spreading my own infection, you can go to at Bryguy Salisbury on Twitter. You can also like my Facebook page, facebook.com/BryanSalisburyCritic. And I'm going to end this show with a little piece of advice that you remember, guys. Even as you're investigating the paranormal, you cannot punch ectoplasm.